Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest is Rick Rosoff. Rick is a very important figure, and he certainly is, and he's also a regular on this program. Rick is the editor of the Stop NATO website. Everybody should follow the website on a daily basis. It expresses powerful opposition to global militarism, and that's exactly what NATO stands for. I don't think listeners to this program need that explained to them, but it's worth repeating. There are new listeners all the time, and maybe they're not quite as knowledgeable as the regulars or regulars to PRN in general. But NATO, as the way I phrase it, is a killing machine. It's not an organization dedicated to defense. It's an organization for offense, and it literally is risking humanity's survival this present day. With its agenda. It wants to be a global police force. It wants virtually all countries except America's enemies incorporated into NATO, and America funds about 75% of NATO. So America calls the shots, applies pressure to the other countries, gets them to go along with things they often don't want to do, and what they end up doing is, you could just sum it up by saying waging war on humanity, just lurching from one war to another. When will the next one be? Oh, Rick, where does this thing end? I mean, Obama just a few days ago declared open-ended war in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's very good to be back on your show, and it's very good to have your show back on the air. We all missed you immensely, Stephen, and as you know, I've mentioned to you, I mean, people not only all over the country, but throughout the world, you know, were concerned about you and calling me and contacting me, and we were all trying to figure out where you were. But so, I mean, if you don't know how much you're appreciated, I guess a moment of crisis like this will demonstrate it to you.
Well, Rick, I really do appreciate that, and I must say, I think I mentioned it on this program, when I came back, I knew exactly what I wanted to write about before I came back. I titled my first article, Back from the Abyss. I felt I owed my readers and my colleagues and my friends who had no idea where I was an explanation of what happened. So I combined that in an article with material on things that I would have written about had I been able to, and I focused on Gaza, I focused on events in Ukraine, I think maybe a couple of other things, and I just put that all into my initial article, and I began the same day to get a tsunami of welcome back, get well wishes, and they just kept coming day after day after day, Rick. It was astonishing. I mean, this really was a tonic for me, the idea that the people really did miss me, and they welcomed me back, and it was just glorious.
Yeah, and it's good to have you back. We need all the fighters that we can get, particularly somebody as valiant and as consistent as yourself.
Well, Rick, I admire you, and you're one of the people who inspires me, and your work with Stop NATO is just extraordinary. You put out important information. You teach me stuff every day when I go to the website, important things that I learn, and you've done it for so very long. That's why the website is so important. It literally is a campaign for peace against NATO's agenda for war. You could say U.S.-led NATO's agenda for war, and they just lurch from one to another, Rick.
Well, thanks so much for saying that. I mean, if I had an ideal hope for, you know, what to hope to contribute towards the accomplishment of, it's exactly how you describe it. So that's a real fillip to me, and it's a real encouragement. I appreciate it. On the question of what you initially said, you know, about the current world situation, you know, I think we have a fairly accurate characterization of it coming, interestingly enough, from the current pontiff, Pope Francis. The first two, a couple of days ago, referred, you know, on the occasion of visiting the grave sites of Italian and Austro-Hungarian soldiers killed in World War One, you know, a war that began a century ago, talked about there currently being a third world war operative in the world, one that he described as piecemeal. And I think, you know, one could maybe substitute the adjective sequential. That what we've seen, you know, unremittingly, you know, people can say all the way back to the end of World War II, but I think most pronouncedly and of a more distinct character since the end of the Cold War, you know, particularly since the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, that what we've seen is 23 years of a world war in slow motion, where one part of the world, one individual nation gets thrown into the cauldron after another, into the vortex, but that ultimately, you know, this is global. And it's really arguably global in a sense that the first two world wars, in fact, were not, you know, which covered fairly broad expanses of territory, but were really isolated to Europe, the Mediterranean, and, you know, Asia, as opposed to now where the wars are occurring throughout the world.
Yeah, it's very true, Rick. It's very hard to have a war that literally covers the entire planet, but certainly an awful lot of it was affected in World Wars One and Two, and I mean literally we have a situation if we have a World War Three, with the potential of using nuclear weapons, that we really could have a worldwide war because you start throwing those things around like king size hand grenades, and nobody escapes the fallout from them.
No, I mean, this is the global impact, of course, is instantaneous and irrevocable in today's 21st century in a way that, again, you know, it was not and could not have been in 1914 or 1939 or 1941. We also have to remember, I mean, this is a truism at this point, but it's easy to forget, that it's only perhaps in 1945 that any more or less arbitrary determination was made that World War II began on September 1st, 1939 with, you know, Hitler's invasion of Poland. And surely, you know, preceding that with the Japanese invasions of Manchuria and the rest of China, Italy's invasion of Ethiopia, you know, Hitler's muscling his way into Czechoslovakia and Austria, so that we had a, you know, number of events preceding that, and it's fairly arbitrary in terms of determining when a world war begins, and I think we're in exactly that situation right now, but somebody has finally said it. And, you know, it's the religious leader of, you know, who has a flock of 1.2 billion people, which is not a figure to be ignored. And that, you know, finally somebody has put the stamp on it that it warrants. I think we've talked about it, you know, amongst ourselves, surely, you know, World War, you know, which is sequential or you know, slow motion, as I've alluded to before. But, you know, what we're seeing is one part of the world after another being subjugated and subjugated in the crudest military fashion. And that what we're also seeing is, you know, unfinished business, if you will, from the Cold War period, where the U.S. is going in and most notably eliminating allies it had exploited during the Cold War. I'm thinking of Afghanistan, even Iraq. And to a certain degree, even Yugoslavia, perhaps, you know, with Yugoslavia being at best a neutral country during the Cold War period. And having outlived their usefulness, if you will, the U.S. is now, you know, going in and wiping them out also. But also that unresolved you know, popular insurgencies or uprisings in countries from Turkey to Colombia to Philippines to Palestine are now being moved on, not for peace, you know, not even for military victory, but for extermination, you know, the forces that the U.S. feels, you know, they can't contend with. I would suspect Western Sahara might be next in that regard.
Oh, indeed, Rick. And back in the 1930s, nobody intervened to stop Hitler's incremental march toward full-blown war. And today, Rick, nobody is stopping America, or you could say U.S.-led NATO. I think when I think of NATO, Rick, I really think of America calling the shots and getting the other countries to go along. Maybe a few of them do it more willingly. A lot of them may do it grudgingly, but America has its own way of pressuring and bullying. And you go against the empire, and then you end up in the line of fire. But nobody is stopping America on its march toward what may end up being a global war, and it really scares me very much that this is a real possibility.
No, you're correct on all scores there, Stephen. And one is reminded, as I frequently am at any rate, of the Aesopian fable of the cat and the mice. And that, you know, the cat every day picks off one or more mice, and the mice are helpless individually to contend with it. And, you know, they convene a council where they discuss what to do. And, you know, if you recall the fable, one mouse suggests they bell the cat. They put a bell around his neck so they know when he's coming. But then another says, and who will do that? You know, who's going to place the bell around the cat's neck? And this is what we've been arguing about in the entire post-Cold War period. You know, who is going to call a halt, as you indicate, you know, to the U.S.'s depredations and aggression around the world, even verbally? Because, you know, what is, I think what history is going to record, if there is a history to be recorded, and I'm saying that without trying to be melodramatic, because, you know, should it should things proceed in the worst case scenario, there will be no history books. But history, I believe, will record that this, the act of moral cowardice and debasement around the world in the face of what you indicate, that the U.S. has acted so nakedly aggressively and that people don't even verbally identify it. You know, they don't even, you know, identify the cat as a predator, much less put a bell around its neck. And I think, you know, until that happens, like any, you know, unconscionable creature, you know, an aggressive U.S. military establishment is going to continue to be as predatory as it is until it, somebody calls a halt to it, and no sooner.
Oh, there's no question about that, Rick. America is going to get away with everything it can extrajudiciously, unless no one nation can step up to the plate and stop America. It would take a coal. Russia and China, I think, have the power to really challenge America one on one. But both of those countries really prefer a solution other than getting into a conflict. But if nobody intervenes to stop America, it's going to keep rampaging one war after another. I think it bears close watching, Rick, what may happen in terms of Obama's reactivating his plan for regime change in Syria. I think you certainly know it well. Most listeners may remember last summer Obama wanted to bomb Syria, and the extreme outrage in America in terms of emails and phone calls, etc., to congressmen and senators got him not to end his plan to wage war on Syria, but merely to postpone it. Well, here we are again. You know, what goes around comes around. Here we are again, and all kinds of pretexts are being invented, like the beheading of the two U.S. journalists, Foley and what's the other one?
Sotkov.
And the British journalist, not journalist, but the British citizen, Haynes, the beheading of Haynes, using incidents like this as a pretext for war. I mean, it's insane, Rick. It's like, you know, somebody gets killed in a neighborhood on a Chicago street, and you wage war against the entire neighborhood. That's just lunacy.
Yeah, I would suggest it's even more pernicious than that. Today's news reports, I think CBS News I heard coming to work this morning, stated that a Syrian government military aircraft was shot down by a shoulder launch missile by ISIS. Now, what this suggests, you know, is the more than likely possibility that one of the so-called rebel groups being armed by the U.S. and its NATO and Persian Gulf allies has supplied, anti-aircraft missiles to who knows whom, the al-Nusra Front, or someone closely allied with ISIS, which then simply transferred. By the way, the second journalist who got killed, I'm sure you've seen the American journalist, I'm sure you've seen the report that he was transferred from one of the pro-U.S. rebel groups, was sold, in effect, ISIS, you know, to be held for ransom, I guess, and then not getting the ransom, they killed him. So that we see the degree of collaboration between the very groups that Obama and company are now talking about shoring up, you know, with training and arms, and, you know, who are working hand in glove with the groups that, you know, ISIS in the first instance that the U.S. claims it's combating. So we see this sleight of hand, this duplicity, which, you know, suggests that the U.S. may very well have ordered one of its people to shoot down the Syrian aircraft if that in fact occurred, and that what will happen is the U.S. is engaged in very dangerous brinkmanship with the Syrian government in terms of, you know, intervening without the permission of the government of Damascus militarily within the, you know, within a sovereign nation without the permission of its government, an act of war in short, and that should the Syrian government lock in their radar or something, the U.S. will bomb them. And then you've got full-fledged war. Now, I think with the situation that obtained last year, as you mentioned, when, you know, clearly U.S. and NATO plans to go to war against Syria, French and U.S. plans in the first place, I think we should remind ourselves, you know, were thwarted in part because Russia intervened diplomatically, Sergei Lavrov, foreign minister, though in my estimate, in a manner that really disregarded Syrian national sovereignty and, you know, acknowledged what I thought was a disingenuous claim by the United States about chemical weapons possessed by Syria, and, you know, but nevertheless called the U.S.'s bluff. What has happened in the interim, happen, and this is the most important thing that's perhaps happened in our lifetime, is that the U.S., according to head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Russian Duma, the Low House of Parliament last December, who said, Ukraine is payback for Syria. That's a quote. Ukraine is payback to Russia for having stopped the intended war against Syria. Now that the U.S. has started a war against the entire Ukrainian-Russian border, particularly in the southeast of the country, what is remarkable is that what Russia has not done.
Even
in terms of defending its own citizens, its own territory, you know, Russian citizens have been killed by shellings across the border into Russian territory. Russia has treated dozens of Ukrainian government soldiers free of charge, incidentally, according to Interfax, and then allowed Ukrainian military aircraft to land on Russian territory and take them back to re-engage in the war. And I think, you know, what we have to acknowledge is that whereas it appeared perhaps a year ago, that diplomatic moves by Russia and China in the first place thwarted an intended war against Syria, that the U.S. has retaliated by waging a proxy war in Ukraine, in Europe, which is now, I think, 155 days old.
And I honestly don't believe that the peace is going to hold, Rick. I think we're in an interregnum now, and Ukraine's military was battered by the self-defense forces. The recruits in the ranks, they simply had no heart. Most of them had no heart with waging war in their own people. I mean, the crazies are the right sector group, the neo-Nazi fascists. These are the people that really want war, and they don't want war to stop. But so many of the Ukraine forces simply abandon their weapons. Many of them cross the border into Russia for asylum. They simply wanted no part of this thing. And the weapons, the heavy weapons that the self-defense forces are using, so many of them at least, are ones that they're picking up that were abandoned by Ukraine's military. But I think that the military is regrouping now. It's being rearmed. You have information on the South NATO website that NATO was rearmed. Is sending weapons to Ukraine. And I think this is just an interregnum before the conflict erupts again full blown. But I'm watching events in what may happen in Syria, Rick. Yesterday, John Kerry was in Paris with 20 representatives of 25 other countries plotting the war in the Middle East. He's got a lot of enthusiasm for fighting ISIS in Iraq, but very little enthusiasm with taking on Syria. I think what will happen, Rick, is he may get nobody going along, or virtually nobody going along with his war plans for Syria, but that won't stop him. That won't stop Obama. Obama will simply go it alone and find whatever additional pretext he may need to wage war on Syria, and I see that coming, and I think we need to watch that very closely. What will happen if Syria is bombed? I don't think America is going to bomb ISIS, Rick. I think America is going to bomb Syrian positions. What will Russia do then?
You know, I'm sure I don't know, but I can say that given its almost total lack of response to the Ukrainian crisis, which is far more threatening to the very existential, the very existence, rather, of Russia as a nation, suggests they're not going to do anything in the case of Syria. And I think that's, you know, whatever has occurred in the interim we're talking about, you know, as difficult as it may be to come face to face with it, many people I consider friends are quite angry at me for simply identifying the truth as the truth, which is that I believe the whole crisis in the Ukraine could have been preempted from the very beginning by one simple phone call from the Kremlin to the White House in November of last year saying, thus far and no farther, this is what we'll tolerate, this is what we will not tolerate on our border, and that should have ended the crisis right then. I have to presume that phone call was not made.
That's an important point, Rick. That's an important point. I think Putin, I've said it many times in my articles, Putin and Sergei Lavrov have literally, from the beginning of conflict, go back to last November, have gone all out to resolve things diplomatically. I mean, they've really gone overboard to the point where really they did more than they should have done. But I agree with you. Just drawing a red line, maybe that would have stopped a hell of a lot of what's going on.
I think there's no question but it would have. But look, when you're dealing with an aggressive, headstrong, unconscionable political entity such as the U.S. federal government abroad, particularly, you don't talk nice to it. You don't engage in diplomatic niceties with your valued partners and esteemed colleagues, and the other terms the Russian government uses to describe their NATO enemies, who openly identify Russia as an adversary, right? But Russia doesn't return the compliment. They're still partners, some partners, they're conducting or have recently conducted two war games with Ukraine, one on the ground, Rapid Trident, 2014, one in their Black Sea Seabreeze, which included the participation of at least nine NATO warships, which, according to one report I read last week or the week preceding it, was the largest number of foreign warships in the Black Sea in several decades. I can't imagine when it would ever have been higher in number, so it may be an unprecedented figure. And here we have the U.S. Engaging now a large scale, or leading large scale, 13,000 troop war games in Poland, Anaconda. Ongoing war games in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania, deployment of U.S. paratroopers to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland permanently, the rotation of U.S. F-16s to Poland permanently, the buildup of U.S. military presence in Bulgaria and Romania across the Black Sea from Russia, discussion about increased U.S. and NATO military presence in Georgia and Azerbaijan, both of which border Russia and its south. And what we're seeing, the word Anaconda, by the way, I think is interesting. Some of your listeners may know there's an alleged plan by that name to encircle Russia and strangle it the way, the reptile does its victim.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's been covered in the Russian press, particularly Strategic Culture Foundation. But the choice of the word, the code name Anaconda for the upcoming war games in Poland may not be gratuitous or fortuitous. This may be, very well planned.
Well, I think we're heading for big trouble, Rick. Exactly how it will unfold and when things will happen, I don't know. But I think Putin and Lavrov have the patience of Job. But no one can take more than only so much. And I think they will reach their breaking point where they're going to have to do something more than what they've done already. In other words, draw that red line and say we simply won't tolerate anything beyond this. Russia and China are the only two countries that can say that to America. And if they happen to unite and say it together, it's possible that could be a game changer. It hasn't happened, and I don't know that it will.
I don't think it will, Stephen, as much as I'd like to believe it. There was a recent head of government or head of state meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as you know, and some journalists, making much of the fact that the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is, supposedly a counterweight to NATO. There's no evidence it is. When the vote in the UN Security Council came up last year on the question, earlier this year rather, on the question of Crimea, only 12 countries voted against the U.S. resolution, and no member of the SCO, no observer state in the SCO voted with Russia. They simply abstained. The Russian foreign ministry may try to portray that as support. I hardly see it as such. I think it's an indication of how effective the U.S. has been in the post-Cold War period, and to use some of your own words, bullying or bribing people into submission, and that absent real international support. And let's admit that the Russia-China combination is important because Russia alone has a nuclear arsenal that matches that of the United States. Let's be perfectly blunt about this. It's not a question of conventional military force. The U.S. could wipe Russia off the map if it was simply conventional. China really has not the nuclear capabilities to retaliate against the United States to protect itself effectively from the United States. It's only the Russian nuclear arsenal that makes it a country that has to be paid attention to and whose needs have to be addressed or respected. And if Russia abdicates that responsibility, as it appears to be doing in my estimate, then it is a very dangerous period in history.
Well, it really is a very dangerous period. A line I've used a number of times is saying this is the most perilous time in world history. I don't think anything compares to it, Rick. We've had some pretty dire times before. I have an article. I don't think I got this one out yet. I've got one sitting that I haven't gotten out yet. But in one of my articles, I went back to the beginnings of World War II, and Roosevelt making a speech to the U.S. public. It was called the Stab in the Back speech, where he literally was promoting war. And my understanding is that he wanted war before World War II began. And of course, he'd go to the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor, but he wanted war in Europe, and he actively supported what Britain was doing. he used this speech. I guess it was one of many, but he used this speech. It really is openly promoting war. I mean, it could have been Obama making a speech like this, but it was FDR instead. And finally, he got the war he wanted when he goes to Japan to finally attack Pearl Harbor, and U.S. intelligence tracked the Japanese fleet across the Pacific. It didn't warn the commander at Pearl Harbor because we needed a mass casualty event, just like the later one of 9/11, U.S. sponsored state terrorism. You could blame America for Pearl Harbor and Japan for years before Pearl Harbor went way out of its way. Japan was a vile empire, let's face it, Rick, back in those days. I mean, it was waging brutal war in Asia. But aside from that, Japan wanted no part of a war with America, and it tried very, very hard to negotiate peaceful relations with America. But Roosevelt wanted no part of it. Roosevelt, like all you, like Wilson in World War I, wanted into the war. Roosevelt wanted war. Maybe U.S. presidents have something in their DNA, Rick, that they feel if they don't wage a major war, they're just not cutting it as a U.S. leader. So even Franklin Roosevelt, my God, you could just imagine. You could just imagine what Obama does if FDR supported a policy like that. But he got the war he wanted, and because of the Axis Pact, Hitler had to jump in, and then Roosevelt got the war in Europe he wanted, and bingo, we had World War II.
You know, for any of your listeners here in Chicago, as we both are, I invite them to go to the Museum of Science and Industry now, and in the section where the German U-boat is, they have reproductions of newspaper headlines preceding and during World War II, and one is the Chicago Tribune before Pearl Harbor, and it reports on a meeting on a ship in the Atlantic between Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. Of course, this is McCormick's Tribune at the time, and the opening lines are to the effect that Roosevelt and Churchill have signed a pact to overthrow the governments of Germany, Japan, and Italy, and police the world. That's a rough paraphrase of the opening paragraph. And this is, you know, several months in advance of Pearl Harbor.
Well, you can bet if the information came out then, the plan was in the works long before that, Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that Roosevelt, not too long into his first term, decided that he wanted war, and it was just a matter of manipulating events to be sure he got the war he wanted. Well, I don't think it was any mystery the kind of leader that Hitler was when he came to power. And ironically, both Roosevelt and Hitler came to power at just about the same time, 1933. Events, of course, proceeded incrementally throughout the 1930s. Hitler could have been stopped very, very easily, just like America would be stopped if Russia drew a red line. But nobody did a thing to stop Hitler, so he just proceeded to one move after another until we finally got to a world war. But I think Roosevelt wanted events to turn out exactly that way, and certainly wanted the kind of event. America was a pacifist country then. Congress was pacifist. The U.S. public was pacifist. Just before World War One, ahead of World War One, Wilson formed the Creel Commission to turn a pacifist Americans and I guess Congress into raging German haters, and the same kind of scheme had to repeat to get the public and Congress on board to fight another war. Well, you know, you get attacked by a foreign country, I guess that's reason enough. It certainly is more reason, Rick, even if it's manipulated, than the fact of two Americans and one British subject being killed by any means at all. That certainly is not a reason for war.
No, it's a pretext.
Well, indeed, it's a pretext. You've got a legitimate reason for fighting back if you've been attacked. And back in those days, there was no Security Council. Today, the only way you can go to war with another country is if the Security Council authorizes it. Not the Congress, not presidents, not either party, not the U.S. courts, only the Security Council. And most people don't understand that. And the U.S. media never report that. But unless the Security Council authorizes attacking another country, doing so is illegal aggression, and the Security Council has not authorized a war in the post-World War II era. The wars that America engaged in, not sure about all of the wars, but not the Korean War, not the Vietnam War, not the Panama War, not any of the Iraq wars or Afghanistan or Libya or Syria, no Security Council authorization, and anything Obama intends to do against Syria, Rick, and he claims he has authorization, which he does not even the War Powers Act. He doesn't have any authorization, but Congress is apparently isn't lifting a finger anything to stop him. So I expect that he will attack Syria, and that's what really concerns me, and I'll be watching that very closely.
Yeah, I fear you're right, and we should all be alert to that possibility. We may hear about it any hour.
Whether it'll come that quickly, I don't know, Rick, but I really think it's going to come. I think he felt that he couldn't do what he wanted to do last summer after blaming Syria wrongfully about a major chemical attack in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta, and the Syrian government had nothing to do with it. Syrian government had nothing to do with any alleged chemical weapons attacks, but the so-called rebels, the ones that America supports, had everything to do with all of these chemical weapons attacks, and Saudi Arabia, at least in some instances, supplied the chemical weapons. But again, you never get any of this reported in the U.S. media, and nothing about the rule of law. So you see where we're heading incrementally, Rick. And if we get into a war with Syria, and if the Ukrainian war resumes, and I honestly believe it will, then again, we proceed again on the road to a possible global war.
That's, what I think everyone from ourselves here in Chicago to the Pope in the Vatican are suggesting.
Well, if the Pope wants to come on this program and talk about that candidly, he'll be a welcome guest, Rick.
I'll extend your invitation to him. Next time I speak with him.
As an aside, I once came within about 3 feet of Pope John Paul. I forget the year. Oh, it was maybe 25 years ago. It was a long time ago. He came to Chicago, and he stayed at the Cardinal's house maybe a mile and a half from where I live. I forget the exact street. It's on a corner, and I think the exact corner that it's on. But he came there, and he stayed at the Cardinal's house, different Cardinal than now. And he came out of there. There were people assembled early in the morning. He was heading off for his day's events, and he came out on the balcony just to wave to everybody the way the popes usually do. Mm-hmm. And I stuck around. I was there. I stuck around. And soon enough, he came out in his limousine. And I think there were some cars in front of him and in the back of him, and they stopped literally in front of where I was standing. His window was rolled up, but I literally was 3 feet away from the guy, separated only by his rolled-up window. If it was down, I had a conversation with him.
Yeah, I think the current Pope might be a little bit more receptive than John Paul II would have been. I hope so.
No, I was not a supporter of John Paul II. we'll have to give this Pope a chance. He certainly did not have a good record in South America, but if he wants to be a peace supporter, I'm all for him.
I'm with you.
But again, so much going on, Rick, and of course we just got through the Gaza war that literally could resume a different form at any time. And in a smaller way than America's campaign to wage aggressive war, this is what Israel does to Palestine on a regular basis since December 2008. Three major conflicts with Gaza. One only lasted 8 days in 2012, Operation Pillar of Cloud. The war, Operation Cast Lead, December 2008, January 2009. That was 22 days. And of course, the latest conflict lasted 51 days. And in the words of others who could witness the devastation firsthand, they reported that Operation Protective Edge, which was the name Israel gave it, was far, far worse than the other two combined, maybe far, far worse than the other two, plus a whole lot of other Israeli attacks on Gaza or Palestinian territory. And in my estimation, it's only a matter of time before the next conflict erupts, and nothing, as far as I'm concerned, in the implemented peace agreement terms will be implemented. Nothing has been implemented so far. The blockade remains. Some of the things agreed on, like fishermen being able to extend their waters, their fishing waters, from 3 to 6 miles and then to 12 miles by the end of the year. There have been at least 4 reported attacks on Gazan fishermen within the limit that Israel imposed. We've got regular attacks in the West Bank. We've got all kinds of Israeli crimes being committed on a daily basis, and nothing is being done. And the incident is out of sight and mind. I was asked on a Press TV interview, Rick, whether the public outrage because of Operation Protective Edge, whether it would have legs and really could end up making a difference. And my answer was, It resonates now, but wait and see. The conflict will, it was still going on at the time, the conflict will end, the headlines will disappear, and the public anger about what's going on will ebb, and we'll move on to different topics, and that's exactly what's happening.
No, I'm afraid you're right. I think it's something, you know, to tie in a couple issues. One of the reasons why I'm sure the U.S., in addition to simply wanting to grab Ukraine for energy transit purposes, military expansion to the east, you know, and such like, was, in fact, to, you know, confirm the suspicion of the Russian parliamentarian that Russia would be paid back in Ukraine for having stopped a war in Syria. But I think the flip side of that is bogging Russia down in the, you know, the Ukraine conflict also distracts its attention and disallows it or doesn't permit it to respond to a new attack against Syria. So let's sew that up. I mean, that's part of the intent, no doubt. Let's also recollect that at the shortly after the recently concluded NATO summit in Wales, about which the world paid too little attention, in my estimate, and the fact that Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the Secretary General, stepping down, his last day will be the last day of this month. You know, and has been one of the more they've all been you know dutifully compliant and slavishly obsequious, you know, vis-a-vis U.S. interest, as you indicate. But that he has stated that General Breedlove, the American Supreme Allied Commander of Europe for NATO, the top military commander of NATO, has always been an American, going back to Dwight D. Eisenhower I, has stated that NATO has to look increasingly outside of Europe, outside of the Euro-Atlantic area. In other words, reiterating the fact that NATO has become the world's first global military force. That immediately following Operation Cast Lead, the Israeli assault against Gaza, that Joop Hoop Scheffer, at that point the Secretary General of NATO, Rasmussen's predecessor, a Dutchman, became the first NATO Secretary General to visit Israel. To put his imprimatur on Operation Cast Lead. And in general, you know, Israel is the first country in NATO's Mediterranean dialogue, which includes seven countries with Libya slated to be next, and I'm sure Lebanon and Syria to join it shortly thereafter, to be given an individual, a special individual cooperation program with NATO. I believe in 2008, 2009, thereabouts. And that, you know, what we have to see is all these conflicts are interrelated. I mean, they're not just simply, you know, the way the commercial news presents them here, you know, one after another after another. I mean, there is a red thread that runs through what's going on. And as I think you've indicated pretty clearly, you know, by the way, when I mentioned, you know, the Chicago Tribune report of 1940 or 1941, you know, about the Britain and the United States planning to go to war against the Axis countries even before Pearl Harbor, I think the operative sentence was, and that afterwards police the world. Because I think that was the intention as early as 1940, if not earlier. And I think that is, in effect, you know, the program that has been accelerated to its terminal phase right now.
Oh, indeed, Rick. When you mention Syria becoming part of NATO, you mean a new Syrian government that America installs if it ousts the current Assad government. Certainly, America doesn't want Syria to be part of NATO, and I don't think Syria wants to have anything to do with America's killing machine.
No, it would be precisely, you know, a post-regime change Syria as it is in Libya. I mean, as soon as the Gaddafi government is overthrown, Gaddafi was murdered in the autumn of 3 years ago. You know, within days, the U.S. ambassador to NATO and the NATO General Secretary Rasmussen both talked about welcoming Libya into the so-called Mediterranean Dialogue military partnership with NATO, which today includes Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Mauritania, and Morocco, and, you know, intends to have every country, you know, if we look at the entire Mediterranean Sea basin, the only countries bordering the Mediterranean Sea and the two island nations within the sea, Malta and Cyprus, that are not NATO members or partners, and I'm assuming that, you know, Libya and Cyprus effectively have been moved into that category, are Lebanon and Syria. Those are the only two countries in the Mediterranean Sea that are not members of NATO or members of either the Mediterranean Dialogue or the Partnership for Peace or other transitional mechanisms NATO has used to integrate the militaries of other countries. So let's, you know, when we talk about, and this is, you know, in many ways the complement to the past and thoroughly, you know, unmissed French President Sarkozy's, you know, Mediterranean Union or Union of the Mediterranean, which Gaddafi, by the way, you know, Muammar Gaddafi was the only head of state that refused the invitation to that meeting. you know, to convene that, you know, that organization by Sarkozy, stating at the time that what France and its allies were doing was trying to recreate the Roman Empire, in which case, if you recollect the Roman expression from the Mediterranean Sea, Mare Nostrum, RC, the Mediterranean has become a NATO sea, just as the Black Sea has become a NATO sea.
Rick, and as you pointed out, NATO members and partners and so on comprise about one-third of the world's nations, and U.S.-led NATO wants many others to be able to establish a global police force to literally rule the world by force. And of course, I mean, it's basically doing that now, but if you can get enough nations into NATO, absolutely subservient to U.S. interests, then you've got total unchallenged world dominance, which is America's long-time plan.
That's it indeed. And the fact that if you and I know this in Chicago, then surely the heads of state and the foreign ministers and the defense ministers of every nation in the world are equally aware of this if they're not going out of their way to ignore it, in which case, if they're not opposing it, then they're complicit.
Well, they certainly know it, and they're not ignoring it, and they indeed are complicit because they do nothing. I admit that most smaller nations really don't have much to go up against America with, but unity can bring remarkable results, and it comes right back to your idea of a red line, Rick. If something isn't done to draw a red line, I'd like to see it with more than just Russia and China. I would like to see many countries stand up to America. That's the only way to stop this thing, this juggernaut, this killing machine, and if enough nations unite and say no, then I think even America's might will have to step back and pause and wonder, what do we do next? And maybe it'll literally stop America's killing machine in its tracks. It's a wonderful dream, Rick. I'm certain I won't see it in my lifetime. You're younger than I am, so maybe you will. I can only hope that's the case.
Yeah, you put that very well in all respects. You know, what is necessary to stop it, and the moral imperative to, you know, exert every effort to ensure that it is stopped, and it's stopped peacefully if possible.
Peacefully, of course, and literally, I mean, there literally is not a day of peace. There hasn't been a day of peace in my lifetime, Rick, or your lifetime. And looking ahead, I can't envision a day of peace in the rest of my lifetime. And what I can envision is what's going on now to erupt into something far more serious. And I've used the expression a number of times that the weapons used in World War I and World War II were toys compared to the stuff that we have today, which is more than just nuclear bombs. I mean, the horrific chemical and biological weapons. I mean, you can unleash a holocaust. Maybe in 24 hours, you can unleash a global holocaust. And the idea that leaders of nations, even powerful ones, would risk something like this happen, what kind of people think this way? Would they endanger their own future to do this? I guess the lust for power, Rick, makes people think they can get away with anything. And we'll stop short of this Armageddon idea. We won't let that happen. But, you know, you take things a certain way, and they have a way of going beyond what anybody expects. The unexpected always happens, and the unexpected this time could literally be mass annihilation.
Yeah, you're no doubt familiar with the line from Milton's Paradise Lost, where Lucifer, cast into the underworld, says, "Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." And I think there is a mentality, satanic if you will, that says, you know, better to bring the whole world down on my head than not to be able to run it as I choose to. And, you know, that's a perverse line of reasoning. It's a dangerous, ultimately a lethal one, but it's one that exists. We also have to admit there's something perhaps even more dangerous than the threat of nuclear holocaust. I realize that's a controversial statement, that sometimes the very threat that you're indicating will make somebody hesitate about setting into motion a chain of events that might lead to that catastrophe. What the U.S. has been working on assiduously over the last past couple of decades is the ability to launch the equivalent of a nuclear strike with conventional weapons, which could be just as successful in destroying the military capability of an adversary. And let's be honest, we're talking about three of them, Russia, China, and Iran, and a major Eurasian continental powers, without having to employ nuclear weapons. This is, you know, amongst other things, a hypersonic aircraft, prompt global strike, where the U.S. hopes to be able to hit any site on Earth in a matter of minutes, perhaps seconds, and that with you know, increasingly sophisticated super stealthy bombers that can penetrate air defenses and radar and so forth. So the U.S. has plans underway. This also includes Cyber Command for cyber warfare to effectively dismantle the control a communications computer, and you know, so forth, systems of other. So let's be honest, that there may be plans that will have the same geopolitical effect of a nuclear war without actually having to use nuclear weapons. And that sounds nice and it sounds humane the way the U.S. is going to portray it. But if it leads to you know, global domination by the world's sole military superpower, that designation, of course, is Obama's, then you know, it may be sparing of you know, people may not be corpses, they will be slaves.
Yeah, they certainly will be, Rick, and it's not the kind of world I want to live in. America, in my opinion, isn't fit to live in now. Can you imagine a world dominating America with the policies that it pursues? I simply can't conceive of wanting to be part of a world that operates that way, but we're certainly heading in that direction.
Yeah, I fear so. And again, I don't know what we need to do, what can put the brakes on it. You know, there may be the cutting of history, as Hegel says, right? There may be some unforeseen development, you know, that nobody anticipates, that throws a monkey wrench into the works. But I surely cannot tell you right now, except that what you're saying is making people aware internationally, and hopefully a combination of the world citizenry and whichever state actors who come on board can put up some kind of opposition to this.
Well, it would be lovely to see, Rick. We certainly haven't seen it so far, and whether it will happen or not is very much up for grabs. But again, the situation is very dangerous. I just can't stop writing about this stuff, Rick. The notion that that literally we could have another global war with the kind of weapons we have, whether they're used or not. And a couple of times in my articles, I quoted the father of America's nuclear navy, Hyman Rickover, around 1983, I believe it was. He testified before Congress, and he said essentially that when nations go to war with each other, they will use every weapon in their arsenal to win if they have to. You know, they nuclear weapons won't be used if the conflict can be won without them. But if it takes using nuclear weapons to win, then they will be used. And he was warning Congress. He's the guy who founded America's nuclear navy, having second thoughts on nuclear weapons, and literally, basically saying, I mean, we're literally putting humanity up for grabs with risking the idea of having a war where we can use nuclear weapons and possibly risking humanity's survival. Well, apparently his comments fell on deaf ears, but we need some people like that speaking out forcefully today. He was an important figure of his day, and of course we don't have any of that today. A guy like Breedlove is the exact opposite. The comments that he makes, the exact opposite of what Rickover warned about.
Yeah, I mean, it's good of you to remind all of us, you know, of what you just stated, and because it's something that once you look at it, you wonder why it hasn't occurred to you until, you know, it's laid out to you, and that is that a country fighting for its very existence, and wars nowadays aren't the nice, you know, border disputes they would have been, say, in the 18th century or something. It's total war, total annihilation, total victory, total defeat. We have to be. That's modern war, and it's, you know, arguably started at the end of the you know, the 1800s, but certainly from World War One onwards. There is no question but that to start a war and to lose it is to lose your political leadership, to lose your country, to lose territory, to lose your economic standing, and so forth. And any political entity, any nation faced with that catastrophe, will figure that nothing is worse than you know, unleashing total war in response, and that if we're going to perish anyway, I hate to say it, but why not go down in blazes? And this exactly, you know, increases the possibility for some you know, events spinning out of control, heading to some absolutely apocalyptic conclusion, and that people are willing, and under some, you know, perverse and misanthropic variation of game theory, you know, willing to see how far an adversary will permit somebody else to taunt them and to you know, provoke them, you know, hoping or planning or calculating or gambling that this will not result in a global catastrophe is, you know, sociopathy writ large. And anyone guilty of that really belongs in a mental institution.
Yeah, Rick, and there are crazy military people like half a century ago, like General Curtis LeMay from World War II, but also around during the Kennedy administration. He and others advocated a nuking Russia, and it would be a small price to pay if we only lost, say, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Boston. But nuke them while we have a big advantage. Well, maybe there are crazies around today, Rick, who think America America has a big advantage, which it does not, because both countries can match each other blow for blow with delivery systems, able to deliver pinpoint accuracy to any target that they want to strike. I imagine there are Curtis LeMay types around today who believe that we should wage nuclear war with Russia and get rid of them once and for all, and then take on China maybe and do the same thing. And the idea that something like this possibly could happen is a I'll forget the name of the movie, Strange Love scenario.
Yeah. No, I mean, this shouldn't even be a possibility. It should be ruled out, conclusively, comprehensively, absolutely. That's not even a possibility to allow a situation to obtain where this could occur. I mean, it's pure and simple. You know, if self-preservation isn't the basic rule of life, then what is? And if we allow people to trifle with not only our own existence, but that of the species and the planet, then, you know, it's long past time to call a stop to that, certainly, no?
Oh, indeed. Rick, I remember William Blum, who wrote a number of books, including one that influenced me so much called Rogue State, just enumerating all of the mischief that the CIA has done in toppling leaders and assassinating them and so on, going back over half a century. And it wasn't in the book, but I think separately he once imagined that if he could be president, what he would do in office, and he enumerated so much on day one, on day two, on day three, like maybe declaring peace, calling all U.S. Troops home from abroad, and so on, halting America's wars, basically, and doing a lot of other very important things, and then on day four, he'd be assassinated. I have no interest in politics, Rick, but if I could hold a position like that, how glorious it would be to end my time on this earth by declaring peace, closing down U.S. bases, bringing home all the U.S. troops, literally ending America's police state apparatus, doing things like this. And if that wasn't a legacy to leave behind, even for a short period of time, I would say doing that would have made this life worth living.
People have been martyred for far less, and far less noble things, certainly.
Oh, indeed so. But of course, the exact opposite happens, which is reason why we lurch from one war to another. America literally has a permanent war policy, and this is the theme of a number of things that I've written, including an article I've yet to get out. But literally, this is U.S. policy going back, certainly post World War II, but I think post World War I, and it literally has been the case ever since then. And this is the danger that we live in, that we literally, we can end up destroying humanity to save it or to control it. And this is the reality of today's America. The idea that America wants peace. I think the way Gore Vidal put it, I think, Rick, was waging perpetual war for perpetual peace that never comes because it's never intended.
Yeah, that's correct, of course.
Oh, it's dire, Rick. It gives us a lot to talk about on this program, and you cover the ground so well in the Stop NATO website and updating readers on exactly what's going on. The NATO summit, deploying troops in Eastern Europe, very close to encroaching on Russia's border, literally threatening Russia, the rapid reaction force, the big lies that are repeated about Russia all the time, claiming Russia has done things it has not done, Russia supporting peace, and yet blaming Russia for inciting violence and war and so on. And all of these acts can literally result in a possible East-West confrontation that can end up resulting in the unthinkable.
Yeah, the unthinkable and perhaps the unsurvivable.
The unsurvivable, indeed. And this is the reality that we face. As a kid growing up, Rick, I remember World War II well. I don't remember the day it began. I think it literally began on or around the day I entered kindergarten. I was only about 5 years old, so it was pretty tough for a kid that age to remember anything. But most of the war I remember very, very well. And I remember in grammar school the drills that we held, nuclear bomb drills, where we would we would either duck under our desk, for all the good that would do, or we would go down the fire escape leave out classrooms. The entire school would leave the classrooms, go down the fire escape, and assemble in the schoolyard. Well, I can't imagine what good that would do under a nuclear attack. But these were the drills that they put us through. And as a 6 or 7 year old, I mean, I was scared about all this stuff. And I guess the other young kids didn't understand any of it, so they were scared too. So the fear I felt as an unknowledgeable young kid who couldn't understand anything was nothing compared to the fear I understand, because I do understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I went through the same thing later during the 1950s, during the actual atomic scare, and I think it was more to mobilize and regiment thinking and behavior in the United States than it was to, of course, preserve life in the event of a nuclear exchange with the former Soviet Union. Many of my classmates, for example, had fathers had built bomb shelters in their backyard, which would not have withstood a good mortar shell, much less an intercontinental ballistic missile. So that this is simply the government putting up a pretense of marshaling support for people to defend themselves, when in fact what they're trying to do is build up war hysteria for political purposes. And we're in a situation right now. I have to tell you the truth. Perhaps a week and a half or so ago, I went to Google News and I just typed in the word nuclear, and the first two entries related to Ukraine. These mainstream Western media, I think U.S. media in both instances. One of them was that Russia conducting military exercises with a nuclear component, and the other was somebody in the Russian Defense Ministry or perhaps in the military stating that Russia would need to refashion its military doctrine to permit, as the U.S. and NATO in fact permit, the use of first strike nuclear attacks. These were the first two entries that came up in Google News when you typed in the word nuclear, and I don't suspect anything comparable to this has occurred in the post-Cold War period until now, to give you some, and give us some appreciation of the severity of the time and the condition we're living in right now.
Yeah, true enough, Rick. I mean, we have a very dangerous flashpoint in Ukraine. I guess you could say Sarajevo was the flashpoint that ignited World War I. It was crazy because assassinating an archduke should not be a pretext for a world war, but it happened. And I guess you could say Poland was a pretext for World War II. Britain drew the line and said that Poland was attacked, and then Britain would get involved, and Britain did get involved. And now we've got Ukraine. Will Ukraine become the flashpoint for another global war? I certainly hope not, but that was the title of the book that you contributed a very important chapter to, Rick. Again, the title, A Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. And it's incredible, Rick, because you could go back before November 2013, and I wonder how many Americans even knew a thing about Ukraine, whether there was even a country named Ukraine. Well, I think most Americans know there's a country. They have a rough idea where it is, but they have no idea what possibly may happen as a result of what's been going on there since last November.
Yeah, one is reminded of the statement ostensibly made by the American writer and humorist Ambrose Bierce that God teaches Americans geography through war.
Yes, indeed so. Indeed, so I don't think most Americans knew much about Iraq or where it was exactly before the Gulf War in 1991. And again, I mean, Americans learn geography by the wars that America wages. And it really is shocking and disgusting. And what's really shocking and disgusting is there isn't the kind of outrage that we saw back in the 1960s, early 1970s against the Vietnam War that played a great role in bringing that war to an end. It didn't happen fast. It took 10 years to end that damn war. And we had different people in Congress, different people in government than the kind of people we have around today. We had Nixon, for sure, but we had senators like Fulbright, Frank Church, different people than exist today. And even then, it took 10 years to end that damn war in the middle of the 1970s. And what's going to happen now?
Yeah, by the way, I would encourage your listeners. I've just encountered it for the first time, and it's frighteningly relevant. It's posted online. If you type in the words Mark Twain, Battle Hymn of the Republic, and in parentheses it says something like brought down to this day or something, or broken, brought down to this day, I believe. And it's his variation. He suggested new lyrics to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. This is in 1901, incidentally. I know it's on, I think Wikipedia has it. My closing comment would be that. Please look it up and see what, arguably America's greatest writer had to say about the issue.
Oh, indeed. So we're just about out of time, Rick. And Mark Twain also said that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And it seems to rhyme in the most awful way, Rick.
That's very good.
We've got about a minute left. Quick final comment.
I'm glad to have you back. You play an indispensable role. There has been a noticeable vacuum, in your absence. And it's led to, some degree of discouragement with myself and I'm sure with other people. I mean, you're a rallying point around which we go for information. We're able to exchange information and that we walk away, encouraged to continue the fight.
Well, Rick, you're very kind. And indeed, I am back. I continue my recovery as an outpatient, but I'm working with wonderful doctors and I'm in good hands. And just the idea that I'm back doing what I love best, Rick, to me, that's the best medicine of all.
Very good. Welcome
Rick,
back.
I look forward to having you back.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thank you, Rick. I haven't said this for a while, but I want to remind my listeners to make this program a regular habit. Make PRN a regular habit.